So I have the best spot around this table, two great rabbonim sitting on my right and on my left. And someone maybe introduce them.
Rabbi Leibowitz knows everyone by name.
Yes. So maybe just everyone should just introduce himself.
Yeah, sure.
I'm Dan Geisler. I live in Cedarhurst.
And Dan is a very, very high acclaimed doctor.
Aaron Twiskin, introduced himself to everyone before. Mm-hmm. Avi Khan, we're here in Vancouver.
Aaron Friedman, we're here in Vancouver.
And Shane,
okay.
Also acclaimed doctor.
Daniel Lasky, live next door. David Lasky, I live next door.
Menachem Wolfish from Queens.
Next door.
No, you very helpful.
Albie Cohen, North Premier.
Eric Cohen, Friends of Avisha.
Wish. Also
there. Adrian Grace.
Ian Chassan. Chassan.
Ellie Rossman, North Premier.
Not Connor Rossman, I live in North
Premier. And you're sitting right next to your father, right?
Nelly Gantrow, North Premier.
Mahal Gortz.
Alicia Graf, Rabbi Leibowitz's gabbai.
It's very serious.
Does the Rabbi want to take questions or start listening to Vitero, or should just open up to them and take questions?
So thank you. Thank you, Dr. Neumann, for hosting this evening. It's always a pleasure to see wonderful, wonderful younger light in America. And I'm so inspired by many aspects. I was born in America, but I was born on the Lower East Side, Hasidic family. My father and mother were both. My father was, and my mother is, a survivor. So I grew up in a somewhat different background. And before my bar mitzvah, we moved to Kiryat Sanz in Israel. And in my many visits to America and visiting different communities and different towns, I am inspired by so many professionals in America, business people, professionals, and their love of Torah. And so many of them dedicating hours every day to learn Torah and the support of Torah. So it's a pleasure to be here with you tonight. So these two younger ones sitting on my right and on my left have been quote me a lot. They do a lot to disseminate my Torah, which is to me a big schus, and I thank them profoundly. And I'm happy to be here with you tonight. So I'll be happy to respond if anybody has any inquiries or questions.
Just want to thank the Rav for spending time with us this evening, and thank, of course, the Newmans for hosting and everyone for coming together. Just to everyone who davens in our shul has heard the Minchas Asher quoted on an almost daily basis, certainly a weekly basis, it's a rare opportunity, so I just want to urge everybody not to be shy at this moment, because you're going to kick yourself later that you're sitting around the table with the Baal Minchas Asher, with Rav Asher Weiss, and you had an opportunity to ask what you can ask, and it's a unique opportunity. So I just encourage everyone to please take advantage and appreciate the wisdom.
So Rabbi Leibowitz urged everybody not to be shy. I urge you all to be shy. To try. At least try. No questions.
No questions.
All questions have been answered.
Okay. So I'll start with one just somewhere.
Malcolm is really my partner. He's also an anesthesiologist. And we've been working together for the last 11 years.
Mm-hmm. And he was my chavrusa in Karen Biavne.
Yeah. And he keeps me grounded when possible. And he doesn't take me flying, and when I'm like, no, you can't go anywhere. So
And I remember when Ari was deciding whether he's going to Rabbi Leibowitz, whether he's going to go to law school or become a rabbi. We all know Baruch Hashem for this community and all of Klal Yisrael.
And that was the best choice ever made.
Yes. So just something that Shaila that came up, not specifically to me, my brother had a question of a patient of his, a lot of doctors here, who it's actually an interesting story. The patient, not even a Jew, but he wanted to see what the Shaila would be. The patient came to him for a procedure, like colonoscopy, and there was some suspicion that, you know, that something was wrong. And the patient told him, I'm having this colonoscopy, but I'm supposed to go on a cruise to Hawaii. I don't want you to tell me anything that happened in this procedure until I get back from my cruise. I'm going this week. In 2 weeks, I'll be back. I don't want to hear. I don't want to know anything. Sure enough, the person comes for a procedure, and they find something, you know, bad.
Troublesome.
And now the question is, you know, he's gone on his cruise, and obviously going to be ruining his procedure, his cruise. That's why he didn't want to hear anything about it. And he specifically told the doctor, I don't want to know until I come back. So again, and usually in this situation specifically, maybe not made that much of a difference, you know, because you have some time. But in general, the question is, you know, how much information, and I see it sometimes, you know, we have patients that come and their family members come with them. And they'll say, you know, even though the mother is totally with it, they'll say to the doctor, whatever, you know, we don't want you to be telling our mother, you know, anything. She doesn't need to know anything. So why should we get her worried? Why should we not? Aside from the medical, legal aspect of what needs to be said, so halachically, you know, does the doctor have to tell the patient everything? Or can they rely on their own judgment as far as what should be said and not said and so on and so forth?
So before responding to your question, I just want to tell you, Lee, a ridiculous story, a similar story to the person says, I'm going on a cruise, don't tell me anything. So there was a terminally ill patient who was in a very bad state, and a totally unknown from family. And they asked the doctors, do everything. You need to resuscitate, intubate, do everything you can. And the doctor was taken aback because usually when you have a terminally ill patient, he's dying. There's nothing we can do to help. And most people would ask, don't take any extreme measures. So he said, we planned a trip, you know, to South Africa, to a safari. And I don't want him to ruin our plans. You know, we're supposed to be leaving in 2 days. So please, you know, just do anything you can to keep him going till we get back, which was very, very strange. So I've been through this dilemma. My father was a very special person, true, huge Talmud Chacham, passed away from cancer almost 6 years ago. And we asked the doctor treating him, you don't need to tell him everything. And the attitude today in the medical establishment is that a doctor will share all the information with the patient. I think this attitude developed for various different reasons. One is doctors are afraid of claims, you know, so doctor feels safer. I told you everything, so you can't take me to court. You can't make any claims. It's also a modern philosophy. Patient deserves to know everything about his condition. In Israel, I think doctors are more responsive and forthcoming than anywhere else in the world. In Israel, by law, you are required to do what the family wants you to do, even if the patient has no choice, and no chance, and he's terminally ill and he's dying. And even if he's brain dead, the family wants you to keep him on the machine, you can't. But I always say, this is a Yiddish Medina, much more than we would like to acknowledge. And almost in every hospital, doctors are responsive. And if a family who knows the patient asks the doctors to give him all the information, doctors will cooperate. And I think in many cases it's justified. I saw my father passing away from cancer, and I saw my wife passing away from cancer. Hope is so important. And if you take away hope, you rob them of everything. He's left with nothing, and he has no strength to cope with his condition. And sometimes hope is all we have left to offer patients. So I do think we need to be very sensitive. Share as much information as needed, but leave some room for hope. And especially when we're dealing with an elderly patient and you see a loving family who are on top of things, if there's any medical information that they need to know, they know, and you trust them what's best for the patient. And that is my attitude. So you definitely need to share information with the patient, and even sometimes even more important with the family. If you see a loving family who care for the patient, which is not always the case. So I do not think we have any halachic or moral obligation always to share all the information with the patient. In Shulchan Aruch it says that when a patient is dying, you need to let him know, Shiyatzava al Beisoy. Maybe there are things you would like to tell his family and write at Tzavua. But the Shulchan Aruch also says if it might affect his well-being, then you should not share that information. In halacha, there's a concept of yesuva daita. Yesuva daita means psychological, emotional well-being of a patient. And we are machal Shabbos just to give the patient a feeling of control and calm. And sometimes this is yesuva daita, telling a patient that it's all over and we have nothing to offer is sometimes a horrific predicament. So I do think we should try to leave some room for hope.
If by sharing all the information, there's an issur, right, we have to be careful with the words that we say to patients, because if we cause them any tsar, then it could be, and the words that we say leads to, I guess, their death, then it's considered like we killed them. Is that?
That might be a slight exaggeration, but why put it in such harsh terms, you know? In halacha, yesuva daita is considered pikuach nefesh. What are the limits to this concept? I doubt that in modern medicine or psychology we would say a person died because of information we gave him. So in many areas we adhere to halacha, even though modern science or medicine would not confirm the halacha, but we still adhere to halacha. Would I say that a doctor that shared information with a patient is a retzeach because you killed them? I wouldn't go to that extreme. It is also impossible to dictate exactly what you say, how you say it. It's a very, very delicate balance. So I never use extreme language. I wouldn't say that it is as if you brought about his demise. But still, we have to be very sensitive and leave room for hope.
So we know that we're living in this world, and as of now, like, it's been a little bit chaotic, you could say, and it's never been as bad as it's been for most people. My question is, like, like, what's the best way to, like, approach this right now? What's going on with, like, with all the anti-Semitism? And is, like, Mashiach close? Like, you know, is, like, how should we, like, move forward with every day there's something else? There's something, is it
you're a young boy, you just became a chosen, and your life is so bright and sunny. to say it has never been as bad as it is.
You got engaged yesterday.
That's why I say. A few years ago, a very, very famous Rosh Hashiva in Israel spoke about the matzav in Eretz Yisrael between the frum and the non-frum, and he said, there has never been a worse gullus than today. And I was so taken aback, and I wondered, does this person know anything about gullus? Does he know how it feels when the goyim are shouting outside and you take your family under a bed to hide, or you lock yourself in a closet if they tear into your home? They might just murder you and your children. It has never been as good as it is today. Never. And America is still the most friendly gullus we have known in 2,000 years. It's definitely better to be in Israel than in America. We have a lot of difficulties and hardships in Israel. Terror, rocket attacks, but it's home. It's where we should be. But if you need to be in Golos, America is probably the most friendly Golos that we've known in 2,000 years. There is a rise in anti-Semitism, which is troublesome. I hope it will subside, and I think it will. I think every time there was war in the Middle East, there was always a spike in anti-Semitism. We hope and pray that it'll go away, that it will subside. Whether Mashiach is coming, I'm still waiting for a quarrel. 200 years ago, at a bunim of Peshischer, I don't know whether you're familiar with the name, whether people here have a Hasidic background. So the Rebbe of the Kotzker was Rebbuna Mepeshischer, and you probably heard about Reb Mendel HaMakotzk. What was unique about these tzaddikim of Poland was the way they expressed themselves, kurz and sharp. Very few words, to the point. So talking about Mashiach, he said, those who say don't know, and those who know don't say. There are some, including me, that don't know and don't say. It's not necessarily the ones that don't say no, but it is clear that those who do say don't know. There are some that don't say. Hi, Ellie. I told Dr. Newman, I know two out of the three, Yankov and Ellie, and I'm happy to know the third tier. Nice to see you again. I shared with Dr. Newman when we got to know each other. Not in happy circumstances, but we should share many, many simchas, and we have.
Been happy since we saw.
Yes, Baruch Hashem. So I'm one of those that don't know and don't say. I don't say because I have nothing to say. We've been waiting for Mashiach throughout the ages, and we wait for him every day. But we need to plan, long-term planning, and we cannot rely that he's going to be here tomorrow. When the going is rough, we say some more Tehillim. We try to be more diligent in our mitzvahs, learn some more Torah. Hope and pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that things will get better.
So, I've been talking to Mark, to Rabbi Leibowitz a little bit in terms of chinuch. In terms of chinuch habanim, chinuch habanos. And one of the questions that I struggle with, particularly in this neighborhood at large, right? In terms of, and I presume Rabbi has an understanding of this neighborhood just with the gentleman sitting next to you on either side. But my question specifically is when you have children of a certain age that begin to express certain opinions, and granted, parents have chesrona, you know, we have our own chesrona where we allow our kids to see certain things, and, you know, parents continue to work on themselves. But in terms of chinuch, is there a certain place where
compromise is permitted in halakha? And does that demonstrate to the kids a certain kind of weakness where the parents are compromising their emunah or their bitachon, and that way it opens kind of like a Pandora's box or becomes a slippery slope? With boys, it could be, you know, getting to minyan at all, getting to minyan on time, what shear you want to be in, a higher shear or a less high shear. With girls, it could have things to do with the way they dress in terms of sneers or the things that they watch. And if there's certain social pressures where they express certain misery, it's up to us not to be their friends and to be their parents, no question. But I'm curious as to whether or not the Rav has any kind of guidance in terms of whether or not compromise is appropriate in some of those areas, or and you continue to do your best to raise them, or are there certain places where it's just, this is, you're better off in terms of chinuch saying, this is who we are. We're observant Jews, and this is what we do, and this is who we are.
The question is such a general question, it's easier to respond when questions are more specific.
I could get
because
there's a whole table full of people.
Okay, so let me just try to address the general question, and if you wish, you could get into specifics. Chinuch is all about balance, and many times we compromise, especially with kids that are growing, you know. So on one hand, of course we compromise all the time. On the other hand, discipline is one of the greatest gifts we need to give our children, and children need to know that there are things that are right and things that are wrong, the things you will have and things that you won't. Many times my mother, she's 93 years old, Shetachiyad Biyas HaMashiach, she was always very articulate. And many times she asked us when we wanted something, is this something you need or is it something you want? And there's a difference between the two. So children growing up in a community like this, you know, this is the age of plenty. And we have more than our parents in Europe or grandparents would ever dream about. From what an average family throws away after the day is over, the food that an average family throws away after a Shabbos, you could feed a family that's five times as big a week in other societies. So our kids are used to abundance and having things that I as a child would never dream of having. Am I being recorded? So don't tell anyone, when I was a kid, I so much wanted a baseball glove. And I never got one. So I used to, sometimes one of my friends would lend me his glove. And I don't remember feeling very resentful. I just knew that there are things others have and we don't, you know. So this understanding that you're not going to get everything you want is very fundamental and it's very important. And it's part of a disciplined life. But on the other hand, yes, we are compromising and we give our kids many things. And especially when young kids grow up, compromise is even part of halacha. I'll just give you an example. So the time of chinuch is keben shit keben sheva. 6 or 7 years is when chinuch begins. If you're going to start being mechanech for children to say brothers when they're 6 years old, then you miss the train. That is very late. On the other hand, there's a ritva in Sukkot Daf Gimel, which most of the poskim agree upon, that you're not yoytze chinuch only if you give your kids a proper mitzvah. I have one son and 6 daughters. Many years ago, my son was, I don't recall how old he was, probably 5, and he wanted dalet minim. And once again, 45 years ago, we couldn't afford to buy an esrog and a lulav to every one of our children. Today, every little kid has proper dalet minim. It's a different world. So I bought my son a lulav because there's nothing similar to a lulav, and hadassim. But instead of a lulav, I cut some branches of an eucalyptus tree, and I gave him a lemon instead of an esrog. By the fifth day, Chol HaMoed, he asks me, Tati, is this an esrog or a lemon? It's almost the end of Yom Tov. Took him some time to realize. So you can't be Yotze Mitzvah Chinuch with a lemon, even if your kid is dumb enough to think it's an esrog. But you're still not Yotze. So when we are mechanech our children in Birchas HaMazon to say one brocha, that's not Mitzvah Chinuch, because you can't be Yotze with one brocha. So obviously, the entire realm of Mitzvah Shebedibur is different. It's different. If your kid is sitting in a sukkah psula, you're not yoytze chinuch. And if he's going to make a brocha, that's anti-chinuch, because he's making a brocha levatola. Same with dalad minim. But mitzvot shebedibur, there's no other option. You can't teach a four-year-old kid to say the entire Berachas HaMazon. But you can't start teaching him Berachas HaMazon by the time he's going to be seven. So even in halacha, chinuch is about compromise. It is about compromise. So, when our girls are little, we aren't makbid about tznius as when they grow older. So I'm just trying to explain that, yes, chinuch is about compromise. So the question is always, where do you draw the line and where's the balance? So Chazal say, La'olam tei smol doicha v'yamin mekarevis. And the Chazanish in a beautiful letter writes, U'lefa'omim shneihem mekarevim. Smol doicha v'yamin mekarevis, U'lefa'omim shneihem mekarevim. And I think our day and age is a time in which shneihem mekarevim. But on the other hand, discipline is very important. And kids need to know, yes, this is who we are. This is our Torah. This is the way we live. And this is what we expect from you as well. So it's all a question of balance.
I was in the Erev Tisha B'Av year, and I happened to have been in my room when everything happened. So over the next couple of weeks, I know people, including myself, who, when they were davening, didn't want to feel a type of connection with Hashem that like you normally want to have. So I guess my question is that okay to feel that way? And then what type of feelings do you think somebody should be having toward Hashem if something like that happens?
People react to trauma and tragedy in many, many different ways. So when you ask me, is that a proper feeling to have? Feelings are something usually we don't choose. They just come. So the question would not be, is it okay to have a feeling like that? The question is how to cope with feelings like that. As I said, people respond to tragedy in many different ways, and the most striking example is the Holocaust. Some people that were very firm at the outset of the Holocaust dropped everything and then never came back. Other people came closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So people react to tragedy and to horror and to trauma in many different ways. And it doesn't necessarily depend how much of a tzaddik you are. So your initial response is something that is spontaneous. It's not your choice. So the question is, when you have feelings like that, what do you do, and how do you move out of it? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not the angry type. He made our bodies, He made our minds. He created our emotional system. And many times when I speak to my Talmidim, I say, what is most important is to have a relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. And having a relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu might be sometimes being angry, sometimes being loving, most of the times being appreciative. But many of us just don't have a relationship. They're never angry at a Kodesh Baruch Hu, because to be angry at a Kodesh Baruch Hu, you really need to feel him. And he is part of your life. You're never angry at people you don't know. Were you ever angry at the king of Thailand? No. How could you? Were you ever angry at your mom?
Yeah.
I assume you'll have a loving mom, I'm sure.
They've never been angry at her a moment. It's me.
So what I mean to say, sometimes we're angry with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, and the Kodesh Baruch Hu is forgiving, but you need to move on. So the most important thing is to have a relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, and that is a gift. You're never angry at a Kodesh Baruch Hu if he isn't part of your life. So when we witness trauma, we don't choose how our nefesh, how our neshama responds. Yesterday I spent some time with the Morris family, and it was very, very meaningful, sad, and important. And they lost a child. So we all need to try to move on for the sake of our families, our children, our own well-being. I don't want to speak at great length. You know, it's late by night. I don't want to bore you. Coping with tragedy is one of the biggest challenges in Emunah. And after the Chet Ha'Egel, when Moshe Rabbeinu turns to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hoyedi'enin was drochecho, Har'enin was kvedecho, the Gemara says in Brachos Dav Zayin, Moshe was troubled just to understand Tzadik v'ra'ala yirosha v'toivloi. Why do bad things happen to good people? And obviously that question troubled Moshe in the aftermath of the Egel. You know, we're the chosen people. But as the chosen people, we have experienced more persecution, suffering, gullus, torture, annihilation than any other people. So we were barely born. The Gemara says in Shabbos Aruva, Kalashem is anat tachat chupeta, and Moshe is troubled. So after all this preparation, and after the 10 plagues, and Yetzias Mitzrayim, and Matan Torah, this our destiny is. This is what's going to happen all the time. And Moshe wants to understand. And it's a machlokes rabbeinu Rabbi Yosi and Brochus, whether Moshe's plea was answered, whether HaKadosh Baruch Hu explained to Moshe. So Minchas Osher Emunah VeBetochen, which is one of my favorite, one out of the 32 favorites for. I shared a thought when Rabbi Akiva is tortured. And Moshe Rabbeinu asks HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Zu Toiro Vezu Schoro. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Moshe Chazoy La'achorecho. So when Moshe pleads with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, show me, what is this about? Tzadik v'ra'avloi. What does the Kodesh Baruch Hu says? What does the Kodesh Baruch Hu say? V'samtichu b'niklas atzuv, v'sakoisi kapi olecha. V'hoyu b'avor k'voidi v'asoresi iskapi, v'ro'isu esachoyrai. V'ponai lo yirau. The interpretation is, you will never understand with clarity HaKadosh Baruch Hu's ways. Maybe in retrospect, when you see the back of a person's head, sometimes you recognize him, but not with total clarity and total confidence. You need to see his face. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe, the maximum you could understand is V'ro'isu esachoyrai v'ponai lo yirau. So when Moshe cries out, seeing what happened to Rabbi Akiva, Kodesh Baruch Hu says, Moshe, you forgot. Chazoy la'achoyrecho. Didn't you forget when I told you that Yisus was achoyrei? Gzerehi melefonai. This gzere is v'ponai lo yiro. Go back to achoyrecho. Yisus was achoyrei. So Moshe Rabbeinu was troubled with bad things happening to good people and how we cope with tragedy. So it's not, we cannot understand. We just need to accept what we cannot understand. And the most fundamental thing which is important to remember is the way we live in our Amuna. This is just a temporary phase. The real life is Yosel Lovo in Gan Eden. Voilam Azedoima Leprosdo, Voilam Abodoima Letraklin. This is all we know. This is all we experience. But we're just on the way. You're entitled to enjoy the journey. And we hope to do so. We hope it's going to be a very pleasant journey. But this is the journey, not the destination. So, we pick up the pieces and move on.
COVID. So, in the beginning, we didn't know a lot. I think we made a lot of mistakes. How do Poskim approach a situation where we don't know exactly what's going on? It was very confusing in the beginning. The doctors didn't know. Medical science was unclear. So many shilas came up right away. How did Poskim approach that situation when we suffer? That's one part. And also, how do machshava, if a physician does, you know, acts in the best, what they think is the best interest, turns out it was mistaken? How should we think about that?
Did I give you the minchas asha on Corona, on COVID?
Yeah.
But I see it didn't go through.
Halfway through. It must be the second half.
There's a letter I wrote to a young nurse who was devastated because in her fourth shift in the hospital, with no break, she needed to connect the patient to a machine, to a respirator. And it was a different type of respirator. It was one of those Nayad, one of those mobile ones, not a
portable
respirator. And the patient died, and she realized she didn't connect the tubes properly. And she was devastated. And she turned to me. Will I ever be able to make up for this? You know, I feel I killed a person. And I wrote her, this is exactly what the Tur in Hilchos Bikur Cholim writes, Shemet Toimar Mali Veletzora Hazois. And we find this question regarding Poiskim and doctors, and you ask the question regarding Poiskim and doctors. Both the Ramban in Torah Sodom and the Tur, right? A doctor would say, why do I need to get into this? It is almost inevitable. We're human. Doctors make mistakes. Poskim can make mistakes. In as much as we're human, we will make mistakes. But the Torah says, Varapa Yarapa. And this is the greatest mitzvah. So I wrote to this nurse, how many lives did you save since the outset of Corona? That is what you need to focus on. The responsibility to the demise of this person is not upon you. It is upon all those people that were negligent and weren't careful enough and didn't teach their flock to be careful. But you did your best. And oynes lachmona patrei, this is not your responsibility. What you need to focus on is how many people did I save? How many people did I help? So that is the second part of your question. The first part of the question, Poskim must give ruling based on the information they have. I probably know somewhat more about medicine than other rabbanim, but but far less than any doctor, because I'm not a doctor. So a 20-year-old starter doctor knows more about medicine than I do. So we must rely on the data that we get from professionals, from doctors. And if that data is lacking, our psukim will be flawed by its very nature. So the question of a psukim is, when he is aware that he doesn't have enough information and he still needs to give lulu. So we have a somewhat clear set of what do you do when you have a suffix in pikuach nefesh. So having proper information is essential in medicine as it is in halacha. So the tragedy of the beginning of this pandemic is we did not have that information, and in retrospect, many hundreds of lives could have been saved if we would have known more about this virus. But we did our best, and when you do your best, you just lift your eyes to the heavens and say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we try to do our duty in the light that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us to do that duty, and I hope I made myself.
The rough comment about the Shidduch crisis that we're suffering from, which is a tremendous crisis. I think the Rav knows this fully well. The thousands of singles who are finding it very difficult to find a Shidduch, and what makes it worse today than it was a generation ago, that have we made it impossible for boys and girls to meet because of frumkeit or lack of frumkeit? Does the Rav see any solutions?
We're living in a changing world. We would like to go back in the tunnel of time in many different aspects, but that is usually impossible. I don't know what is the origin of this crisis, but I think part of it is the mere fact that the film community is a booming population, and the average age of boys when they get married is 5 or 6 years older than the average age of girls. So there are more girls in the market than boys. And that is one aspect, because with every passing year, there will be more children because we're growing. Even though in Europe, the average age of boys got married and from Europe was 7 or 8 years older than the girls. But that changed after the Holocaust for about 50 years, and then the trend once again is changing. The other aspect is that there's less tmimus in the world. So once upon a time, kids didn't have very high expectations, and they weren't exposed to many things our kids are exposed to. And a boy met a girl 2 or 3 times. They didn't hate each other, so they got married. But in our day and age, that's not enough. Kids have opened their eyes, they know more about life, they have different expectations. So I met a young boy today, wonderful young yeshiva boy, was difficulty finding a shidduch, and he met many girls. And he discussed his predicament with me, and he says, many a girl told him, you're not fun. When I became a chassan, no girl would tell a boy, I'm not going to marry you because you're not fun. So, it's a different world. It's a different age. Halavai, we should be able to bring some more of that purity and tmimus to our children. And we should try. I don't have any magic formula to the Shidduch crisis. And I know it's very painful. There are more and more single boys and single girls and I know quite a few of them, wonderful children who are 25 and 35, and one of the questions we deal with on a steady basis, could I freeze egg, you know, because I don't know where I'm going and what's happening. So, I give a lot of brachas. Sometimes they are fulfilled, many times not. We daven for each other, hoping we should all have nachas from our children.
So I'm a pediatric cardiologist. So part of what we do is fetal echocardiogram, making diagnoses while before birth. So issues sometimes that come up is you make a diagnosis of a very complex heart defect, and parents always ask the doctor, rightfully or wrongly, but like, oh, so what should I do now? You know, what are my options? So in utero, there's not much procedurally to do. After babies are born, oftentimes there's surgical correction. But one of the options, definitely the United States, is terminating pregnancy if it's early on. Usually fetal echoes are recommended about 20 to 24 weeks, because 24 weeks is the cutoff of the New York State. So as a Frum doctor, right, especially with not Jewish patients or even with Jewish Frum patients, we never tell anyone what to do, but as giving options, is it okay to give the option of, let's say, termination in certain cases?
I think by law you are required to give that option. And if you will withhold that information, you might lose your license.
Well, no, so as a cardiologist, so maternal fetal medicine doctors, they're the ones, they're the end result. We're really just giving diagnoses and, then they move to the next step. But I had one case where there was a Frum patient who called me. They had received the diagnosis from someone else, and they just wanted to know sort of how things play out after birth, and they were very concerned about the diagnosis, and it wasn't a very, very favorable outcome in general. So is it okay for me to, and for them, termination was never even, they didn't know that there were some postkin that say that it's okay in certain circumstances. Is it okay to tell them that there are different ways to go within the Frum?
First of all, you need to give them the information, and what they do with the information is not your responsibility at all. And especially in a case in which we're dealing with severe problems or deformations, then many places are lenient, and I am considered a makel in the area of terminating pregnancies. Needless to say, not every problem would justify terminating a pregnancy, even for a male. But when we're dealing with severe issues, I am many times lenient. But you as a doctor, and not as a poisek, I don't think you have any problem of explaining the options to your patients and let them go to their own.
And same thing would be like time of death, like brain death and things like that also. What? With brain death?
You are a doctor. You need to share the information with your patients. And what they do with that information is not your responsibility. One of the common questions, which we don't really have sources in halacha, is confidentiality. You know something about a person, information as his doctor, and then someone calls you about a shidduch, and I am a big machmir. I think unless human life is in danger, you cannot share information that you have as a doctor. So we don't really have any clear sources in halacha dealing with this question, but I think that this confidentiality is so essential and so important that I'm a big machmen in this area. And it's maybe more relevant to psychologists and therapists than to doctors. Anything else?
I was just going to ask what Rebbe ended up saying about psychologists and therapists. Would that confidentiality apply more with psychologists and therapists if someone, for example, calls about a sheikh and you happen to be this guy's therapist? How would that play out in terms of what you're allowed to say?
You just tell him that you cannot share any information. And you must stress to him that doesn't mean that you have information that you're concealing from him. But just explain to him, as a medical professional, you cannot share any information.
Does anybody mind if I ask a second?
I have a question.
So Rebbe was discussing, I believe it was discussing once, about whether or not you could make deals with a Kaddish Baruch Hu for, like, I'll give, you know, years of my life so that my father could have, you know, a certain amount of time. So during that particular discussion, as I recall it, Rebbe, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't want to speak, there was a reference made to a Gemara in Sota about an incident where a Shaliach or a Malach, a Kaddish Baruch Hu, came down to retrieve a particular person and came back with the wrong guy. So, unfortunately, I've been on...
That's a Gemara in Chagiga.
Chagiga. See, that's good. Thank you. I'm not the one who's really asking the kasha on the Gemara as much as I'm asking the kasha on the emotional part of it. So, unfortunately, I've sat in the low chair for both of my parents. Both my parents have passed, and as everybody walks through, they keep telling me about the tapestry that we only see the front. I'm looking at the back, but the front is so pretty. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a plan. Or when you're talking to anybody who suffered a tragedy where it seems like it's not the natural time for these things. I haven't been able to reconcile in my own mind such a Gemara in Chagiga, where it talks about how there is something where, you know, when the Malach comes up with the Kaddish Baruch Hu and they're all scratching their heads, who's that? So if there is a plan, clearly, and we know Kaddish Baruch Hu is perfect, I was wondering if Rebbe could help me understand on maybe in an emotional end, whatever basis Rebbe wants to answer the question, I don't even know where to begin. So.
Well, a Malach could make a mistake, and probably a Kaddish Baruch Hu tells him, give that back, you know. It's your own one, give him back.
I haven't seen the give it back part recorded anywhere.
This would bring us to a broader discussion about the nature of Agadata, which is a very broad discussion. There are many stories in Gemara which are difficult to understand. The tradition of Amuna is, we believe in Hashgacha Protos, everything is predestined, and Tomem Tiyam Hashem Elokecha. The great philosophers, including the great Jewish philosophers, saw a somewhat more complex picture. But the Mesiris and the tradition of Emuna is just trust that everything that happens is predestined, and this is the way it needed to be. I don't think it's the right time and setting to go into complex philosophical discussions. In Minchas Sosha and Emuna VeBetochen, I mentioned the Sefer before, right? So, this Sefer has many sections. Most of the sections are not very complicated. The letters are just Chizuk. But there's one Perek which deals with the concept of Hashgacha Protos, which is a lengthy discussion and a somewhat complex one, comparing the approach of the Rishonim with the approach of the Achronim, which is very drastic difference. While some of the Rishonim limit the scope of Hashgacha Protos, and the Achronim, both the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon, have a consensus to broaden the scope So, you know, it is the Kotzke Rebbe once said, and it's the second quote from that cheder. Yosef das, Yosef machav. But it's worth, he said. I prefer to have more pain and more wisdom, even though having more wisdom might cause more pain. We prefer having maybe a drop less wisdom and less pain. So in the past 300 years, the approach of the Gedolim of every sector assume that Hashgacha Pratis is all-encompassing. And that is the better approach, easier approach, more friendly one. Everything that happened needed to happen. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu has his ways. And we believe Kol Diyoved Rachmon Letav Ovid. But I know how you feel. My wife passed away at a relatively young age, and Rav Shai knew her very well. He was with me throughout this process. She was 60 when she passed away from cancer. I lost a grandson who was 2.5 years old. Mitzvah Shabbos, 9 o'clock, he was sitting in my lap. I was playing with him. 12:30, just a few hours later, my daughter calls me, daven for mayor, and I ask her, which mayor? And she says, my mayor, but he was here 3 hours ago. And she tells me, Hatzolah's in the house, he's not breathing, and he just died. So I've been there, and I know how people feel when tragedy strikes, but as I said before, you know, we believe this is the way it needed to be. And life is for the living. And I admired my children. By the way, you know, my daughter told me I owe it to my living children. They should have a happy home and happy parents. And they found the strength, just as I said before, pick up the pieces and move on. So the more accepted approach is emuna tmima. Everything that happens, happens because this is the way it needs to be. Kodesh Baruch Hu always loves us, and in a way that might be beyond our understanding, it is to the better. It's a pleasure to be with you. I think we had some interesting comments. And we spoke too much about sadness and tragedy. So, Bezrat Hashem, we should get together, and then we'll have all the questions about Simchas. Mazel Tov, Mazel Tov to Dr. Newman and to the Chosan Akala. We should only share beside us those.
Amen.
Thank you.
Okay.